White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Gentlemen and students of the International Jew, welcome to the 52nd episode, chapter 47, on this 20th day of June 2013. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Hadding Scott.
Well, Hadding, we're going to hear the International Jew's complaints against the influence of Jews on American music and morals. And in a way, it's kind of like hearing a sermon on Sunday morning, as we are in our advanced stage of moral decline here in the 21st century, you know, and the music that we have now, that music seems a little, seems a little quaint. But I do agree with them. And you know what? Obviously, as I read this chapter, I just get mad all over again at what these Jews are up to. But, you know, look at the music that we have today. Look at how horrible is some of hip-hop and the kind of criminal sort of lyrics it's incredible. And there's where it started. And is there anything more influential? I think even more than movies and TV, than popular music. What do you think?
Possibly not. You know, Plato wanted to censor the music in his ideal republic because he thought music conveyed bad ideas. It wasn't just the lyrics. The main focus in this chapter is on the lyrics of the Jewish songs, but Plato was also concerned with the rhythm and things like this.
Okay, and now, you know, I want to say to start out, because this is not a long chapter, so we have time to discuss this a little bit. And as I had been thinking all along, when they say jazz and Jewish jazz, I was thinking of the jazz that the mostly Negro jazz, which kind of came from New Orleans jazz, but then turned into a different kind of that trombone-y kind of jazz that was in the 50s and the 60s and 70s up till now. It might not be quite as popular as it used to be. And I always liked that jazz, and I didn't think of it as Jewish particularly. But now I finally learned by looking around at some pages that what they're talking about is the Jazz Age from around 1920 to 1929. Ended with the Depression. This was just basically this popular music that they called jazz. And of course, dances such as the Charleston and the Black Bottom and all that kind of thing that became popular. And all these songs, popular songs that everybody was singing. And as you just said, when you pay attention to the lyrics, they introduced some really stuff, you know, risque stuff, I'm calling it, but that had never been used before and to all these young people and got them used to thinking this way. So this is what the jazz, the Jewish jazz that they're talking about, right?
All right.
Okay, and then they say some of the important, I was looking at this one page here, some of the important orchestras at that time were Fletcher Henderson, Paul Whiteman, and Duke Ellington. Well, they're kind of mild, Paul Whiteman and Duke Ellington. And you said Fletcher Henderson you thought was a mulatto.
He looks like one, yeah.
So we've got a white man and a mulatto and a black man they're mentioning here. But they also are including New Orleans jazz men that moved to Chicago during the late 1910s in search of employment. And there they had the New Orleans Rhythm Kings, King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band, and Jelly Roll Morton, and so on, but then Chicago's importance as a center of jazz music started to diminish toward the end of the 1920s in favor of New York. I mean, you know, everything became New York. And here's some of the early hits. Sweet Georgia Brown, Dinah, and Bye Bye Blackbird, they're calling jazz. And there was nothing so bad about these. And they also, Louis Armstrong is mentioned. Well, here we have Fats Waller and Ain't Misbehavin'. I don't know how bad that is, but Hoagy Carmichael, Stardust. So these are all things that are very, extremely romantic. And then, of course, you had the
Hoagy Carmichael, yeah, that's kind of elevated popular music, really. But Ain't Misbehavin', there's kind of a wink there.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And here they mention Irving Berlin's Blue Skies. This is just making it look nice, you know. This is one of the Wikipedia pages. I just thought I'd try to get some background on what they consider the jazz age. But there's a lot more to it, so I guess we'll just let the International Jew tell us how they see it, and then we can add some things as we go along. So you want to get started?
Jewish jazz becomes our national music. About a year ago, the following article appeared in the New York Times, a newspaper that has never been accused of anti-Semitism, and whose proprietor is one of the best-known Jews in the United States. Irving Berlin, Leo Feist, and other officers of seven music publishing corporations in this city were charged with violating the Sherman antitrust law in an equity suit begun yesterday in the federal district court by the United States government. The defendants, it was alleged, controlled 80% of the available copyrighted songs used by manufacturers of phonographs, player piano rolls, and other musical reproducing instruments, and fixed prices at which the records or rolls were to be sold to the public. The corporations involved in the action were the Consolidated Music Corporation, 144 West 37th Street, Irving Berlin Incorporated, 1567 Broadway, Leo Feist Incorporated, 231 West 40th Street, T.B. Harms, Francis Day and Hunter Incorporated, 62 West 45th Street, Shapiro Bernstein and Company, 218 West 47th Street, Watterson, Berlin and Snyder Incorporated, 1571 Broadway, and M. Whitmark and Sons Incorporated, 144 West 37th Street. The agreement which the government seeks to dissolve is alleged to provide that the defendants would make contracts only through the Consolidated Music Corporation, which they had organized. Many people have wondered whence come the waves upon waves of musical slush that invade the decent parlors and set young people of this generation imitating the drivel of morons. A clue to the answer is in the above clipping.
Well, let's talk about this this lawsuit for a minute. I had some pages, I had some stuff put on here, but I had a problem and I was going back on my pages, and now it's all gone, it's all wiped away. But I did look up, you know, that Irving Berlin was, this was only, what, in 19... what is it? It was not a year ago, they say. So 1920, you know, they were already trying to control all the songs and the copyright songs. You know, they had this place called Tin Pan Alley in New York, where they had all these music businesses consolidated there, all had their locations there. And it was just all Jewish. So they were taking over the whole thing. And I don't think that they lost this lawsuit, because I couldn't find any conclusion to it where they had suffered anything from it. What?
I'm not sure if Tin Pan Alley was originally dominated by Jews to the extent that it was by this time.
Well, by this time it was.
Yeah.
So, and these were all Jews here, and they and old Irving Berlin was a part of it, and yet, you know, he's looked upon as this great, you know, because people love his songs so much they overlook everything else. And he just knew how to write songs that that were appealing. You know, he just had that talent. Mm-hmm. I just think that this is not well known. You know, it's not well known that they had already been charged by the government with antitrust violations. And maybe they had to make some adjustments to what they were doing, and that was how the whole thing worked out. Or maybe their Jewish lawyers got them off altogether. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
A clue to the answer is in the above clipping. Popular music is a Jewish monopoly. Jazz is a Jewish creation. The mush, the slush, the sly suggestion, the abandoned sensuousness of sliding notes are of Jewish origin. I don't entirely agree with that. Note bending is found in traditional music of the British Isles, which is now only found in the Outer Hebrides.
Oh, well.
And it also occurred in ancient Greece. It was Plato considered it.
Yeah, well, that might be, but they're just saying that in, you know, the modern phase of it, you know, it is Jews who introduced it.
I think it's also questionable whether jazz is a Jewish creation.
Well, I thought that too, but the kind that they're talking about. The Jazz Age music, which was almost entirely, you know,
well,
in the hands
of
Jews.
But that's separate from the question of who created that type of music. It's a separate question. They certainly, wherever it originated, they certainly took control of it and used it for their purposes.
Yeah. Well, that's more correct. I didn't like that sentence either, but you have to kind of look at it, what they're trying to get across here.
Yeah. Monkey talk, jungle squeals, grunts and squeaks and gasps, suggestive of cave love, are camouflaged by a few feverish notes and admitted to homes where the thing itself, unaided by the piano, would be stamped out in horror. Girls and boys a little while ago were inquiring who paid Mrs. Rip Van Winkle's rent while Mr. Rip Van Winkle was away. In decent parlors, the fluttering music sheets disclosed expressions taken directly from the cesspools of modern capitals to be made the daily slang, the thoughtlessly hummed remarks of high school boys and girls. The United States government alleged, in the above complaint, that 80% of these popular songs was under the control of the 7 Jewish houses named above, and the other 20% controlled by other Jewish music houses not included in that special group. It is rather surprising, is it not, that whichever way you turn, to trace the harmful streams of influence that flow through society, you come upon a group of Jews in baseball corruption, a group of Jews in exploitative finance, a group of Jews in theatrical degeneracy, a group of Jews in liquor propaganda, a group of Jews in control of national war policies, a group of Jews, absolutely dominating the wireless communications of the world, a group of Jews, in the menace of the movies, a group of Jews, in control of the press through business and financial pressure, a group of Jews, war profiteers, 80% of them Jews, organizers of active opposition to Christian laws and customs, Jews. And now, in this miasma of so-called popular music, which combines weak-mindedness with every suggestion of lewdness, again, Jews. The Jewish influence on American music is, without doubt, regarded as serious by those who know anything about it. Not only is there a growing protest against the Judaization of our few great orchestras, but there is a strong reaction from the racial collusion which fills the concert stage and popular platform with Jewish artists to the exclusion of all others. The American people have been urged and chided and shamed into the beginning of a rather generous popular support of music in this country. And the first thing they see for their money is that Jewish artists supplant the non-Jewish artists and use the prestige of their membership in symphony orchestras to work various small business schemes of their own. If they were superior artists, nothing against it could be said. But they are not superior artists. They are only better known and racially favored in Jewish musical circles. That, however, is a big subject. It will receive attention in its turn. Just now, it is the popular song that is being considered. However, as something which true lovers and knowers of music may meditate upon in view of future studies of Jewish influence in music, this observation is offered. The italics are ours. Now, who is he quoting here?
You're asking me? You know, I didn't have that whole part you just read. I know, it got lost somehow. So, but I think I have this now in italics as the Anglo-Saxon group of qualities, right? Is that what it is?
I'm not sure. Yeah. Meanwhile, yeah, I'm not sure what he's quoting here. I'll just read it. Quote.
Okay.
Meanwhile, the Oriental, especially the Jewish infection in our music, seemingly less widespread than the German was or the French is, may prove even more virulent. Those not temperamentally immune to it catch it less severely, like Mr. Leo Ornstein. And if they ever throw it off, as he has given some signs of doing, seem to be left devoid of energy and, as it were, permanently anemic. The insidiousness of the Jewish menace to our artistic integrity is due partly to the speciousness, the superficial charm and persuasiveness of Hebrew art, its brilliance, its violently juxtaposed extremes of passion, its poignant eroticism and pessimism, and partly to the fact that the strain in us, which might make head against it, the deepest, most fundamental strain perhaps in our mixed nature, is diluted and confused by 100 other tendencies. The Anglo-Saxon group of qualities, the Anglo-Saxon point of view, even though they are so thoroughly disguised in a people descended from every race that we easily forget them, and it is not safe to predict them of any individual American, are nevertheless the vital nucleus of the American temper. Anglo-Saxon qualities, that is. And the Jewish domination of our music, even more than the Teutonic and the Gallic, threatens to submerge and stultify them at every point.
Well, okay, what do you think of that quote?
Well, I'm not that alarmed about German influence.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Well, that's just, you know,
I think the idea of having your art and entertainment express the spirit and sentiment of your own people, of your own nation, mm-hmm. rather than to be used as propaganda by an alien minority, I think that's a very valid idea and important.
Yes, and you know, our theme music for this show is Anglo-Saxon music, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then this music that Flattin Scruggs that we're playing for our music that's just playing on certain times during this month, the Flattin Scruggs music, that's Anglo-Saxon time. Bluegrass is Anglo-Saxon, is traditional American from a certain, you know, area of U.S.
Bluegrass,
and would you call that? Okay, go ahead.
Bluegrass is not as old as people think. Bluegrass originated around 1948. It's largely based on some very old traditional songs. There are lots of old songs that can be traced back to England and Scotland that are used in bluegrass music, but also there are some ragtime tunes and some 19th century Tin Pan Alley tunes that are very popular in bluegrass.
Okay, so, but would that be, would you consider that white people's, white music?
Yes,
you know,
when
I was on the, I did a program a couple weeks ago, you know, and I just mentioned why can't I think of that word? The streaming music, the music that we're streaming this month, being you know, the flattened, being white people's music. I said I think of it as white people's music. I can't imagine anybody but white people really wanting to listen to it that much. And
yeah.
Then these guys made fun of me, Jim Fetzer and his friend Pasquale, when they did a show about what I was saying about them, and they were making Pasquale brought that up, and he said, "Oh, you need to hear say that only white people would listen to this kind of music," and they're laughing, ha 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 ha, you know, here we go, what kind of a white supremacist is she, and so on. But you know, I know it sounds funny to say that this is white people, only white people would probably want to listen to this, but certainly it's only white people that play it, isn't it? And
pretty much.
Okay.
There's one combo called the Carolina Chocolate Drops that I know of I'm not sure if they even play bluegrass. They may be an old time group, but by and large, it's very hard to think of anybody in bluegrass that isn't white.
That's right. And you know, I mean, this is not a music that you find people from other races or even Jews or anything caring about.
Jews actually are pretty interested in bluegrass, but I think they do it to try to get away from their Jewishness, actually.
Yeah, certain Jews who are trying to be not so Jewish.
There's some songs that were actually written by Jews that have gotten into the bluegrass repertoire, like Fireball Mail is a song that was recorded by Flattin Scruggs. And was written by, if you look at the songwriting credit, it says Jenkins, I believe. But I looked up this Jenkins guy, and he was, that's not his real name. He was a Jew.
Well, you know, the way Jews are in songwriting, I mean, so most of our popular music, or at least a large part of it, in back at the time we're talking about, it was all written by Jews. I mean, Irving Berlin wrote probably the bulk of our famous, you know, well-known songs from all that period of time that he lived. So, but I'm just, was going to say that, what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, you mentioned the Tin Pan Alley tunes that were used in bluegrass. What kind were those? That was when it wasn't Jewish.
Well, like some of the disaster songs, I can give you some titles. There's a song about the ship that never returned. That's not so much a bluegrass favorite, but that's the kind of song, you know. Oh, it never returned. No, it never returned.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that.
That's from like 1870s. That's a very early Tin Pan Alley song.
Okay. Well, but that isn't so much into the real Jewish show.
And there's Jewish like writers. Some song, Two Little Boys. I don't remember the rest of it. It has something to do with the two boys growing up into men and going into the army, and one of them saves the other's life or something like that.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that's nice. That's a nice.
There used to be songs like that produced by Tin Pan.
Yeah, those are
in the 19th
sex
century.
Songs. They don't have any sex type lyrics really in bluegrass or anything.
No, the most immoral thing that you'll find in bluegrass music are the murder ballads.
Yeah, right.
Which go back to, in some cases, are traceable back to England, like Knoxville Girl, which I think was originally the Wexford Girl or something like that.
Okay, well, that's good. That's good. Put something into perspective there. So we better go on. Now, we don't have as much time now as I thought we did.
Okay. Let me make a nation's songs, and I care not who makes the laws, said one. In this country, the Jews have had a very large hand in making both. It is the purpose of this and the succeeding article to put Americans in full possession of the truth concerning the moron music, which they habitually hum and sing and shout day by day. And if possible, to help them to see the invisible Jewish baton which is waved above them for financial and propaganda purposes. Just as the American stage and the American motion picture have fallen under the influence and control of the Jews and their art-destroying commercialism, so the business of handling popular songs has become a Yiddish industry. Its leaders are for the most part Russian-born Jews, some of whom have personal pasts which are just as unsavory as the Dearborn Independent has shown the pasts of certain Jewish theatrical and movie leaders to be. The country does not sing what it likes, but what the vaudeville song pluggers popularize by repeated renditions on the stage. And that reminded me of payola.
And the disc jockeys.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, put on the radio, that's what everybody thinks is good.
Payola is not dead. There was a big payola scandal from like 1957 to 1960, you know, which included a congressional investigation. But if you look in news archives, you can find it comes up every 15 or 20 years. There's another payola scandal. I read in the early 70s, somebody was saying that record companies were actually using drugs to bribe disc jockeys to play their records. Drugs and prostitutes.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised. They'd use anything. Why is that better than money? I think that money would work best, but maybe that's easier. Maybe you don't trace that as well.
The country does not sing what it likes, but what the vaudeville song pluggers popularized by repeated renditions on the stage until the flabby mind of the 10, 20, 30 audiences begin to repeat it on the streets. These song pluggers are the paid agents of the Yiddish song agencies. Money and not merit dominates the spread of the moron music, which is styled Jewish jazz. Of the business details, however, more later. Tin Pan Alley, so-called because it constitutes a group of song shops, is populated by the Abies and Izzy's and Moe's, who make up the composing staffs of the various institutions. In this business of making the people's songs, the Jews have shown, as usual, no originality, but very much adaptability, which is a charitable term used to cover plagiarism, which in its turn politely covers the crime of mental pickpocketing. The Jews do not create. They take what others have done, give it a clever twist, and exploit it. They have bought up all the old hymn books, opera scores, and collections of folk songs. And if you stop to analyze some of the biggest hits of the Yiddish song manufacturers, you will find that they are woven on the motif and the melody of the clean songs of the last generation. The music jazzed up a little, the sentiment sensualized very much, and set upon their smutty road across the country.
Well, there you go. I believe that. That has to be the way, because they don't come up with all these ideas. Like he says, they've gone and looked into all the folk songs and even church songs and hymns and opera scores and everything to find ideas, and then they use these things and build another song of their own type on it, popular song.
A lot of popular songs are based on old songs. That's right. And most people don't realize it. Because of absolute Jewish control of the song market, both in publishing and in theatrical performance, it is next to impossible for anything but a Jewish song to be published in the United States, or if published, to get a hearing. The proof of this is in the fact that the Yiddish Trust owns the business and the so-called song hits all bear Jewish names. A typical incident occurred in New York recently. A non-Jewish song composer had produced work of such commanding merit that musical sentiment demanded its public rendition. Jewish manager after Jewish manager was approached, but the combination was unbreakable. Finally, one New Yorker talked out and said something about Jewish combine, which had its effect. A Jewish manager protested that he would be glad to give the work to the public. Rehearsals were held, and the night of presentation arrived. The first number was a solo, and a Jew appeared to sing it. He could not pronounce English words. He sang through his nose. He was most Yiddish in appearance. The long nose with narrow, sloping forehead, curly hair. The second number was a duet, and behold, two Jews appeared, whose pronunciations differed between themselves. The performance was a most hilarious tragedy. The purpose was to kill a non-Jewish product by a poor Jewish rendition. But the Jewish manager overdid it. It needed just that to bring non-Jewish musical consciousness to the surface and to explode the advertised and money-bought notion that the Jew has predominant artistic genius. Say that he predominates in music, yes. He has paid for and organized that predominance. Do not, however, say anything about his predominance in musical genius or art.
That's good.
Non-Jewish music has been stigmatized as highbrow. It is purveyable only in expensively good society. The people, the masses, are fed from day to day on the moron suggestiveness that flows in a hurtful flood out of Tin Pan Alley. The Tin Pan Alley is the name given to the region in 28th Street, between Broadway and 6th Avenue, where the first Yiddish song manufacturers began business. Flocks of young girls who thought they could sing, and others who thought they could write song poems, came to the neighborhood, allured by dishonest advertisements that promised more than the budding Yiddish exploiters were able to fulfill. Needless to say, scandal became rampant, as it always does where so-called Gentile girls are reduced to the necessity of seeking favors from the Eastern type of Jew. It was the constant shouting of voices, the hilarity of parties, the banging of pianos, and the blatting of trombones that gave the district the name of Tin Pan Alley. The first attempt to popularize and commercialize the so-called popular type of music was made by Julius Whitmark, who had been a ballad singer on the minstrel stage. He ceased performing to become a publisher and was soon followed by East Side Jews, many of whom have become wealthy through their success in pandering to a public taste which they first debased. Irving Berlin, whose real name is Ignatz or Isidore Balin, is one of the most successful of these Jewish song controllers. He was born in Russia and early became a singer and entertainer. With the rise of ragtime, which was the predecessor of jazz, he found a new field for his nimble talents, and his first big success was Alexander's Ragtime Band, a popular piece which, by comparison with what has followed it, is a blushing, modest thing.
Well, I want to mention here that I looked this up, and I'm going to link it on the program page, but it says on this Wikipedia page for Alexander's Ragtime Band that there's some evidence, although inconclusive, of course, that Berlin borrowed the melody from a draft of A Real Slow Drag by Scott Joplin that had been submitted to a publisher. What do you know about that? It's a great big hit. Probably, he took the melody from somebody else.
Well, I don't know. Because, well, you know, Scott Joplin was a Negro, and they always want to try to find a way to give credit to a Negro.
Well, that doesn't mean he would take that. There must be some evidence. He says there's some evidence. I don't know what A Real Slow Drag sounds like. So
You'd have to make the comparison.
Yeah. Anyway, I thought I'd mention that.
Berlin has steadily gone the road from mere interestingness to unashamed.
I think you missed it. Was worth noting.
Okay. It was worth noting in view of the organized eagerness of the Jew to make an alliance with the Negro that it was Jewish jazz that rode in upon the wave of Negro ragtime popularity and eventually displaced the ragtime. And I think the blackness of ragtime music may be exaggerated, because actually there were lots of non-Negro ragtime composers. If you actually go back and look, that Scott Joplin is the only one of whom anybody now knows the name, but because, you know, they always like to pay attention to the Negro, but there were lots of white ragtime composers also. Berlin has steadily gone the road from mere interestingness to unashamed erotic suggestion. He is the headliner in homes as well as in the not-too-popular music halls.
Well, I don't know. Mine says not too particular music halls.
Not too particular music halls, yeah. But his stuff, without its music, sometimes savors of vile suggestion. The motif of this business can be clearly seen in the Berlin Big Hits. There are the so-called vamp songs, such as harem life and you cannot make your shimmy shake on tea. Among the successes is the song entitled I Like It. It is a vamp song which has been sung everywhere, even by myriads of children who could not appreciate the full suggestion of the words, but were hypnotized by the atmosphere which the words created when sung, and by older folks who would not, under any circumstances, speak the words of the song, but who are victims of the modern delusion that a little flashy music covers a multitude of sins. I Like It deals with a girl, Mary Green, 17, whose mother reproves her for flirting with the boys. In the writing of this paragraph, it was debated whether the Dearborn Independent should print what Mary replies to her mother. It was argued that printing the words might give a salutary shock to skeptical readers. It was also argued that the pages of this paper never yet had been defiled by obscenity. Mary's words, sung broadcast through the country, are therefore not given here.
You don't know what Mary's words were?
I did look it up, yeah. The gist of the song is that this girl, her mother told her not to kiss this boy, but it's implied that she does a hell of a lot more than that. The expression "do it" is used, and she's also not even loyal to her boyfriend, according to the song. So this girl's a total slut.
Wow. Yeah, well, that's just what kind of thing the Jews would do.
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting.
Readers should reserve comment until they search the piles of moron music rubbish in their own parlors. Readers have listened to much worse stuff than Mary's words, but covered by Yiddish jazz. It takes cold type to show what a song really is. A good test for a song is to try to read it aloud. Few normal people can. Oh, Hi, Oh, as sung by Yiddish comedians, has a stench of its own. It may be commented on more extensively later as an example of the Yiddish practice of having three grades of the same song to suit different degrees of degenerate appetites. Such songs are not the worst by any means. Jewish purveyors to degenerate appetites have a peculiarly devilish system of presenting the same song in two or three grades. There will be the song as it is sold at the music store to addle-pated young men and women who fill their leisure with hearing or humming this syncopated senility. Young men and women who pitiably imagine they are keeping up with the times. The songs thus sold and sung are rotten enough, but there is the same song, Class 2. The theme and the melody are the same, but it goes a little further. There is a line or two in each stanza which dips below even the low standard which Jewish jazz has permitted in some of our parlors. And then there is Class 3. Same theme, same melody, but going to the limit.
Okay, we still have quite a ways to go, so I just wanted to...
Young men about town usually know Class 2 and Class 3. The instance has been known that young women have become acquainted with these lower grades also. Forgetfulness by young men while singing at the piano evenings has given hints of the filthier version. And even where version 1 has been strictly adhered to, the mutual knowledge, politely concealed, has created an atmosphere far from wholesome. The diabolical cunning with which an unclean atmosphere is created and sustained through all classes of society and by the same influence will not be overlooked by any observer. there is something satanic about it, something calculated with demonic shrewdness. And the stream flows on and on, growing worse and worse to the degradation of the non-Jewish public and the increase of Jewish fortunes. If the Dearborn Independent were to print on this page the bare words of the popular songs that are to be found in the parlors of the most respectable section of every city, the reader's sense of decency would cry out against it. The same words, when drawn out by numerous hyphens and covered up with nervous music, insinuate their way into the hummed tones of age and into the lilts of innocent childhood. Between the movies and the popular songs, the Jewish groups dictate the intellectual life of the masses. Among the latest Jewish hits, song hits, may be included these titles: I'll Say She Does, You Cannot Shake That Shimmy Here, Sugar Baby, In Room 202, Can You Tame Wild Women, and an almost endless list of the same nature, some of which titles are too suggestive for print. Yet they have free course everywhere, as everything Jewish does in this country. Ministers, educators, reformers, parents, citizens, who are amazed at the growth of looseness among the people, rail at the evil results. They see the evil product, and they attack the product. They rail at the young people who go in for all this eroticism and suggestiveness. But all this has a source. Why not attack the source? When a population is bathed in sights, sounds, and ideas of a certain character, drenched in them and drowned in them by systematic, deliberate, organized intent, the point of attack should be the cause, not the effect. Yet that is precisely where the point of attack has not been made, presumably because of lack of knowledge. It is of little use blaming the people. The people are what they are made. Give the liquor business full sway, and you have a population that drinks and carouses. After preaching abstinence to the victims for a century, the country turned its attention to the victimizers, and the abuse was greatly curtailed. The traffic is still illicitly carried on, but even so, the best way to abolish the illicit traffic is to identify the groups that carry it on. The entire population of the United States could be turned into narcotic addicts if the same freedom was given the illicit narcotic ring as is now given the Yiddish popular song manufacturers. But in such a condition, it would be stupid to attack the addicts. Common sense would urge the exposure of the panderers. A dreadful narcotizing of moral modesty and the application of powerful aphrodisiacs have been involved in the present craze for popular songs, a stimulated craze. The victims are everywhere, but ministers, educators, reformers, parents, and public-spirited citizens are beginning to see the futility of scolding the young people thus diseased. Common sense dictates a cleaning out of the source of disease. The source is in the Yiddish group of song manufacturers who control the whole output and who are responsible for the whole matter from poetry to prophets. Next to the moral indictment against the so-called popular song is the indictment that it is not popular. Everybody hears it. Perhaps the majority sing it. It makes its way from coast to coast. It is flung into the people's minds at every movie and from every stage. It is advertised in flaring posters. phonograph records shriek it forth day and night. Dance orchestras seem enamored of it. Player pianos roll it out by the yard. And by sheer dint of repetition and suggestion, the song catches on, as a burr thistle catches on, until it is displaced by another. There is no spontaneous popularity. It is a mere mechanical drumming on the minds of the public. There's often not a single atom of sentiment or spiritual appeal in the whole loudly trumpeted success. Men and women, boys and girls, have simply taken to humming words and tunes which they cannot escape day or night. The deadly anxiety of keeping up with the times drives the army of piano owners to the music stores to see what is going now. And of course, it is the Yiddish moron music that is going. And so, another home and eventually another neighborhood is inoculated. But there is no popularity. Take any moron music addict you know and ask him what was the popular song 3 weeks ago, and he will not be able to tell. These songs are so lacking in all that the term popular means as regards their acceptableness that they die overnight unregretted. Directly, the Yiddish manufacturers have another hit to make. It is always the public that is hit. A new song is crammed down the public gullet, and because it is the latest, and because the Yiddish advertisements say that it is a hit, and because the hired pluggers say that everybody is singing it, that song too becomes popular, for it is brief, for its brief period, and so on through the year. It is the old game of changing the styles to speed up business and make the people buy. Nothing lasts in the Yiddish game, styles of clothing, movies, nor songs. It is always something new to stimulate the flow of money from the popular pocket into the moron music makers' coffers. There hasn't been a real popular song of Yiddish origin since the Jewish whistlers and back-alley songsters of New York's East Side undertook to handle musical America. Not one, unless we accept, in genuine gratitude, George Cohan's Over There, a song which came out of a period of strain and went straight into the people's heart. George Cohan actually was not a Jew.
Oh, really?
No, he was not.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Why does he have the name Cohan? Well, that's not Cohen, is it?
Well, the original spelling was K-E-O-H-A-N-E, Cohan or something.
German spelling.
No, they were Irish Catholics.
Oh, Irish Catholics. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. They shouldn't have changed the spelling of their name.
Yeah, it really looks Jewish.
Oh, it does.
Two facts about the popular song are known to all. First, that for the most part it is indecent and the most active agent of moral miasma in the country. Or if not the most active, then neck and neck with the movies. Second, that the popular song industry is an exclusively Jewish industry. But the inside story of the operation of this control of the people's music presents other facts which the people ought to know. And these additional facts will appear in another article. Okay.
All right. So that was the 6th of August, 1921. And, I don't know why we got...
You know, I was thinking as... You're asking me about immoral songs. I don't remember, you know, any immoral songs in bluegrass. And I actually also, I browsed at a book about bluegrass. It was written by a Jew. I don't remember the Jew's name, but even this Jew said that bluegrass was music of white solidarity.
That's
was his
good.
Verdict about bluegrass.
Mm-hmm.
But there actually, there if you go into country music, there is a lot of immoral country music. There's a lot of drinking songs.
Well, that's just because these weak people, like, they have an excuse for drinking because something didn't go right in their life, so now they got to drown it.
Some of it's humorous also.
It's ridiculous.
There's one song that Fiddlin' John Carson recorded. I don't know who wrote it, but the name of the song is "It's a Shame to Beat Your Wife on Sunday when you got Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday."
Isn't that kind of joking or something?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. But, you know, these people like jokes like that. You know, this is, to me, country music, and there's some good country music and good country music performers. But, it's kind of the low end of so many of the lyrics are so bad, you know, and they certainly aren't uplifting at all. They just encourage people to.
Yeah, I really see two trends in country music. There's this kind of some country music is very positive and conveys strength. And I would put Waylon Jennings in that category. I think the ethos that he conveys is very positive. On the other hand, you've got somebody like George Jones, this kind of, sad alcoholic music that I think is really demoralizing.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is.
Jeez. Hank Williams Jr. is sort of in the same category. And you can go back to Jimmy Rogers.
I wonder if these Jews are writing their music for him.
No.
Or helping them. You don't think Jews are into
Williams and Jimmy
music?
Rogers wrote their own music.
Okay.
But, a lot of Jimmy Rogers
doesn't say much
for positive also, but he has stuff like, Camel just got out of jail and he's the fool walked around town or something, getting drunk and getting in trouble. But, there's that trend in country music.
Well, they were talking about here about how this is like a narcotic, or that you don't get to choose what you really like. That music is pushed out and it's said to be popular and everywhere you hear it, so you decide it is, and so that's what you know. You know, it's the same as isn't it the same with TV sitcoms? You know, where we have 60 seconds already. It's TV sitcoms where they put this stuff on. People want to watch TV, and of course, some of them fail. It's true, don't catch on. But if it's considered then popular, people will watch it because they think that everybody.
Yeah, publicity makes a lot of things popular. Although with internet now, it's a lot harder for them to do that. For people that are looking for other things now, they can find them.
Well, I don't know how much they're looking. They just.
That's a good question. They have to know that there's something else out there, don't they?
Yeah, right. So, this was interesting, and next week we're going to continue with the next chapter, which is also about Jewish music, and is titled How the Jewish Song Trust Makes You Sing. That's what it's about. You know, we sing what they want us to sing, I guess. So, thanks, listeners, for joining us tonight, and come back with us next week at for the International Jew.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.